Accession number 19382, Real One.
Walter Miller, Real One, where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in Ealing in London in 1925, I had an older brother and a younger sister.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was employed in the post office at the time, and he, in fact, was born in Glasgow, so I've got Scots background, but I think he came down to London because of the difficulties of employment in Scotland, and we really basically lived in London after that.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Ealing?
Yes, I went to primary school in Ealing and then passed what was so important in those days to get a decent educational scholarship, as it was called, and then went on to Ealing County School, as it was called in those days. And but the war intervened in my education, and rather than carrying on, I left school at the age of 14 and took a job in the post office myself.
So you left school just about the time war was declared?
About 1940, in fact, yes.
Did you actually hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. I think it was pretty well at the time we were being evacuated. Went out to Buckinghamshire, not very far away. But I did hear that. My parents were, I recall, were pretty worried about it. But my attitude to the war, and certainly it developed, I suppose, as the war went on, was not, I wouldn't say patriotism, but certainly that I thought it was a thoroughly and completely justified war. And I was very keen on getting into the forces.
Had you been taking much interest in politics?
Yes, our family generally... like, I suppose, so many families from Scotland, but it wasn't just that. I mean, had a very great interest in politics. I mean, I think at the time, it was a time when, just after the 1920s and 30s, and it was a time of great political interest, and our family certainly very much shared in it, at any rate, and political discussion was a normal conversation over meals and so on. So yes, we all took a keen interest in what was happening in Germany and afterwards.
Were you or your parents members of a political party or movement?
No, we didn't. Some of my family was. One of my uncles was a prospective MP for Ealing, I think it was. But no, we didn't actually become members of a political party, no.
Were you doing any kind of political reading at that time?
Yes, I think so. Although, I mean, I was fairly young at the time. What would I be, 2014 or so, something like that. Or 1925. Yes, about 14, I suppose, when war broke out. A bit of reading, I suppose, mainly the newspapers. But we certainly knew what was going on. And as I say, it was a topic of considerable discussion in our family.
Were there any books or pamphlets that particularly had an influence on you?
No, I don't remember anything like that. We took the newspapers mainly, I suppose. The Daily Herald we used to take at the time, took a political, in particular political viewpoint, of course, then Labour Party. Bias, I suppose, one would perhaps ought to say, but no, I don't remember any political pamphlets particularly. No, I was a great reader, but not so much of politics.
What type of things were you reading?
Oh, First World War books, things like that, adventure stories, and so on and so forth, that type of thing.
Any of the anti-war literature, like Remarque?
No, I don't think so. All Quiet on the Western Front is a much more recent discovery, really.
Did you go to political meetings?
No. I don't think any of our family went to political meetings.
Now, you talked about evacuation. Can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, the whole school was evacuated to Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. My sister, a couple of years younger than me, she was also evacuated to Wendover. But Aylesbury was a very nice place to go to, of course not that far from London. But in those days, I think one tends to lose sight of the fact that for people to move about the country was quite a major undertaking in those days. My family came up once or twice to see us, but really, I mean, to get away to places like that wasn't at all as easy as one thinks of it today. Anyway, we went to Aylesbury, I think it would probably be actually in September 1939, all equipped with our gas masks, of course, and our little labels saying who we were, and were then arrived there and were allocated to billets. I was billeted with a very nice lady in quite a small house. I don't think it had a bathroom actually, but it was a small terraced house in Aylesbury. And the school then did their best, and the masters incidentally came with us, so that provided continuity and also was helpful. And we shared the school with a local grammar school. They part of the time we were there, and part of the time they were there, and it didn't work out too badly.
Do you think your education was heartened?
Well, I think it was. It was interrupted, really. And after a while, and I think this was fairly typical, really, after a while, the family began to think, you know, that the chances of any serious danger were not that great. And they had moved out from Ealing to near Uxbridge. And they also felt that, for reasons which perhaps are not entirely valid, really, that being in Uxbridge would, you know, they'd be out of the main part of London. And they felt we'd be reasonably safe to come back again from Buckinghamshire. So we came back in 1940. But I went to a school in Uxbridge, but I didn't really settle there. And so in the end, I think perhaps mistakenly, really, I left and joined the post office at the age of 14 and a half.
But apart from the schooling side, how did the London children get on with the children in Aylesbury?
Well, I don't remember any difficulty. I think to a large extent the children from London were fairly self-contained, really. I don't remember an awful lot of contact with the local boys, at any rate. The family I stayed with, they were fine. They looked after us very well, really. I have no complaints about that.
What kind of family was it?
Well, it was very much they certainly weren't very well off. In fact, I think the lady was a widowed lady, and she was living in this house. She got a son, I should say, who was married, and they had a more modern house, a little bit outside Aylesbury, and I used to go there particularly for baths, because of the shortage of a bath in the house in Aylesbury itself. They were a very nice couple. They didn't have any children themselves, and I think they tended to look on me as a son, really. And they were fine. Mm. So, I mean, mind you, all this talk about, terribly dirty children being evacuated, I mean, this seems to be the common mythology, really. Well, it certainly didn't apply in our case, and my parents would have been outraged at any suggestion that the children from London, I mean, needed to be washed and generally de-loused when they got to the area where they were being evacuated to. That wouldn't have gone down at all well, no.
Had you had your own bathroom in Ealing?
Yes. We had, although I must admit this, the arrangements there weren't terribly good, but yes, we did have a bathroom there.
Mm. Now, once you returned, were you then in the Blitz?
Yes, very much so. I became in the post office delivering telegrams, actually, and I mean, in a sense, brought us back to London at really rather the wrong time, not that they were to know that. And I joined the post office in July 1940 and worked in Wimpole Street in West Warren. Delivering telegrams all around the West End and so on, and of course the bombing then took place, and the area was quite badly bombed, and we quite used to look out and see the large armadas of German planes coming across the sky, and the danger, which should have been obvious, wasn't terribly obvious to, or should have been obvious to us, but. We didn't pay a great deal of attention to it, I'm afraid. But no, we saw quite a bit of the Blitz, I'm afraid.
Did any bombs fall near you or your home?
Yes, I'm fairly near, but we weren't bombed out or anything like that. And I don't even think we had any windows broken, but we did have the Morrison shelter, the one with a flat top, and you lived underneath the thing, and we spent quite a few nights underneath the Morrison shelter, I remember.
What was it like inside those?
Well, it wasn't too bad. I mean, except that the whole family, of course, had to go under this one Morrison shelter. I mean, the bed, I think the idea of the Morrison shelter was that the actual mattress and so on and so forth would be on top of this thing. And then the Morrison shelter would be a large steel structure, heavy steel structure, which was intended to withstand the house actually falling on it. And it was intended to be an improvement on being under the stairs, which is where we first used to shelter. The Morrison shelter was at least an improvement on that. And we put a mattress under there, and all four, I think it was. My brother was in the army by then, and we all slept under there for quite a few nights. And we did a bit of fire watching too. My mother certainly did, and I did a bit of fire watching.
What was your address at this time?
In Uxbridge, yes, a Bushy Road, 8 Bushy Road in Ickenham, a place called Ickenham, Ickenham, just near Uxbridge. Quite a nice, very nice area, very pleasant house indeed.
And did any bombs hit that road or the neighbouring road?
I don't think so. I don't think they had many bombs actually in Uxbridge. Well, no doubt they did have some. I didn't know very much about what was going on.
What about the bombing in your work area?
Well, that was tremendous. Yes, that really was. I mean, other areas have suffered more than the West End, certainly. But we used to get assignments to go up to the city as well, delivering things, and that was badly, of course, worse affected, I think, than the West End. But I mean, my surviving recollection is that it was of going through, and you were tramping through broken glass and smells of burning buildings, and that was just completely pervasive. I mean, in areas like Poland Street and Soho, actually, oddly enough, that area is where I remember it, and these areas. And yet, people, of course, did their best to keep going. But it was really, really very bad in that area. And when I reflect on the situation, I think that it was really rather wrong to have youngsters, as I was at the time, going around in that situation. But I don't know, people didn't think about it particularly in those days. I mean, things were so different. I mean, even the working week, for example, I seem to remember it was 54 hours. Well, that really is quite a long working day for 14, 15-year-olds. And you were pretty busy as well in working these hours. And not only that, you worked on Saturdays and Sundays. It really was quite a demanding job, but of course one didn't think about it in those terms. I think the first pay check I got for working these 54 hours was 14 shillings, actually, which obviously is about 70p now, isn't it?
Were you mentally upset by what you saw?
No, I don't think so. No, I think we were pretty resilient about it, really. I don't think anybody was terribly upset about it, no.
Did you ever get injured?
No, no. And I don't know anybody who did either, for that matter.
Were there any particular bombs that fell, or buildings that were hit, or streets that were hit that you recollect in central London?
Well, only the ones I mentioned in Soho, particularly. I can't remember any other specifically. I mean, the area was quite badly affected, but it was more isolated buildings, I mean, which of course were then converted into emergency water tanks, and you know, quite large. These emergency water supply tanks were put up where the buildings had been, quite a few buildings were heavily sandbagged. Of course, I mean, Berkeley Square House, for example, which was used for the Ministry of Shipping and was concerned with convoys. I mean, had enormous numbers of sandbags outside and so on. But as I say, I think, I mean, obviously the city and the docks and so on were very much worse affected. But nevertheless, Soho was quite badly burned and destroyed and so on.
Who had access to these emergency water tanks?
Well, the ordinary fire brigade would have had, and what they call the AFS, Auxiliary Fire Service, would have. I mean, they were put there. I mean, because obviously the ordinary mains water supply might have been damaged or destroyed, and these were intended to allow them to get water from somewhere. Well, I mean, another thing, I mean, you did tend to get, particularly in the morning, was the ground, the streets, I mean, had large amounts of debris, particularly pieces of incendiary bombs and things like that, which were, well, littering, well, they were around anyway in the streets, and of course we were rather keen on picking these up as souvenirs.
How did public morale stand up to the Blitz, as far as you observed?
Well, as far as I could see, it stood up very well indeed. I don't think that there were one or two instances of people being rather sensitive, perhaps oversensitive, really. I remember, for example, that we used to, of course, like everybody else at the time, we used to grow a lot of vegetables and food and so on and so forth and have allotments. And you needed to have bonfires and to get rid of the debris, or at least that's how it worked in those days. I didn't, they were quite so keen on composting then. And on one occasion, I remember one of our neighbours who was an air raid warden or something, and the German bombers were attacking in quite large numbers, or at least flying over. And he felt that this bonfire might be signalling to the enemy aircraft. I mean, it sounds laughable now, but my family were exceedingly annoyed about this. And, but I mean, that was just an instance of people being paranoid, I think perhaps would be the way to put it now. But anyway, my family were very, mind you, I mean, they knew what day of the week it was. I mean, I remember, and it shows what a frightfully tiresome youngster I was, even in those days, that when the Germans had plainly conquered France and we'd been thrown out at Dunkirk, I remember saying to my parents, well, actually, that must mean we've lost the war, doesn't it? And I well remember their response. They said to me, you mustn't say that. Now, I thought that was rather an interesting response, in the sense they didn't say, no, that's not right. What they said was, it's not wise to say that sort of thing. And surely they were right, of course.
Did you or the people you mixed with feel any hatred of the Germans as a result of the bombing?
That's an interesting question. The bombing, I'm not sure what the answer to that is, really. I can't honestly say I felt quite that way about it. I mean, if you contrast that with the way one felt about the Japanese, and, I mean, I think the answer probably is no. But certainly when I subsequently heard about what was done in the Holocaust and the camps to the Jews, I was utterly horrified. But as I say, right from the outset, I mean, I think we had some information about what was going on in Europe, and I was completely convinced that the war was completely justified. I mean, I felt, and I think most people in this country felt, that the Germans had been given every opportunity to come to a reasonable settlement and hadn't done so. I'm not sure I would see things in quite that light now, but I think that was the way I felt about it at the time.
So you were doing your postman's job in the Blitz. How long did this go on for?
Well, about three and a half years. I got promoted. In the post office in, I suppose I must probably have been about 17, and so I'm not quite sure what that makes it. But I went off then to work in Uxbridge post office on the counter and sorting letters and that sort of thing in Uxbridge post office, and I left the West End then, at any rate, and then fairly soon after that, of course, I got registered, I suppose, when I was, which was the end of when I was 17, I suppose, and then got called up soon after I was 18.
How did you feel about being called up?
Oh, I was very glad to be called up. I was perhaps sounds silly to say so now, but I was very determined to do my bit, and I thought, as I said earlier, it was thoroughly justified. And I would have felt very disappointed had I missed the war.
What was the procedure once you got called up?
Well, you went to... I joined the Royal Navy. This rather surprised me that I'd been allowed to do that. I'd expressed a preference for joining the Royal Navy. But I didn't think anybody would take much notice of that. But actually they did, and did allow me to join the Royal Navy. My father always said, don't join the infantry at any price. And his two pieces of advice to me were, A, don't join the infantry, and don't volunteer for anything. Certainly not joining the infantry was a piece of sound advice I subsequently found. But I did express a wish to join the Royal Navy, and that was honoured, and I did join the Royal Navy and went off to... the Royal Arthur Camp, as it was called, at Skegness in Lincolnshire.
What were conditions like there?
Well, it was April, and it was pretty cold April in 1944, and it was next Butlin's holiday camp. And Butlin's holiday camps then are not like what they are now. I mean, it was fairly huts and, you know, fairly primitive accommodation, really. And not too comfortable, really. But then you didn't expect it to be particularly comfortable. People, I think, accepted things fairly readily in those days. And you were in with everybody else, you know. And it was okay. I mean, I must say also, the Royal Navy did go to very considerable lengths to try and sort out and put square pegs into square holes and round pegs into round holes. They did do a very careful scrutiny of people and tests and so on and so forth, so as to try and get people into the right jobs from their point of view and the sort of jobs that would be suitable for them and the people concerned. Intelligence tests, that sort of thing.
How did the people in charge treat the recruits at Royal Arthur?
Oh, I think fairly reasonably, really. I mean, there was obviously a big job of assimilation, but I think one has to remember, and I think possibly a bit of a contrast between earlier in the war, that at that stage, the people who were joining up were 18-year-olds, basically. Now, 18-year-olds are pretty adaptable, and generally, at that time, at any rate, are generally people who do what they're told. So it didn't cause much difficulty, really. But you did at Royal Arthur, you did do 6 or 8 weeks, I think it was, of basic training, which meant marching about and learning how to operate with a rifle and present arms and so on and so forth, and a little bit of time at firing as well.
Were you happy or unhappy at Royal Arthur?
Oh, I would say I missed home, of course, and, you know, 18-year-olds perhaps do a bit, but I think I was reasonably content there.
Did the course do you any good?
The course? Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, I think the forces generally are very good at assimilating people, quite unlikely people, really, and getting them to accept their norms of behaviour and so on. And I think they did that there, and that was no problem. And once they'd sorted out what particular branch of the of the service you'd be in. And as I said earlier, they took considerable care to do that. And you knew which branch you were going into reasonably soon. You were fit, and you knew you'd be going on then to further training at other establishments. So you knew your time in Royal Arthur would be fairly limited in any event.
Was there a service attitude which they were trying to inculcate as opposed to a civilian attitude which they were trying to knock out of you?
Knock out, I think, is perhaps too strong. But yes, I think, as I said earlier, I think the forces were really very good at that, at instilling in people what they thought was the right attitude. Mind you, I mean, one has to remember that it was a highly disciplined population in general at that time. So I don't think the forces had a particularly uphill job at the time. I mean, they might possibly, one might argue they would now, but in those days it was people were used to doing what they were told, and as I say, were very disciplined population. I remember reading subsequently some permanent secretary saying, we'd never have believed that you could introduce all the controls that were introduced and rationing and so on and so forth in the British population. They were so prepared to accept discipline, really, and I think that's perfectly true.
What happened to you after Royal Arthur?
Well, after that, I went across to train as a they used to call it telegraphist. It was basically a radio operator. And went to the Douglas on the Isle of Man. That was an enormously long train journey, I remember, because the links between Lincolnshire and the Isle of Man were not entirely easy. But and also, I think that the normal link would have been out from Liverpool, but I think they were worried about, even then, about submarines operating outside Liverpool. And so we actually went from Fleetwood and went across by boat from there. And of course, although we were in the Royal Navy, none of us had ever been to sea before. And the trip across from Fleetwood to the Isle of Man can be rather rough, really. And so everybody was pretty seasick in doing that. However, Douglas was a very nice place to go to.
Were you classified as RN or RNVR?
RN, actually, yes. I mean, we weren't regular, obviously, appointments or whatever it was, but yes, we were classified as RN, actually, yes.
What happened to you in Isle of Man?
Well, we trained to be a radio operator. In those days, the standard method of communication was by Morse code. When I say communication, it was almost entirely one-way communication because ships almost never transmitted anything for fear of being their position being given away. And so it was almost entirely receiving messages. And we learned to do Morse code at quite extraordinary speeds, I have to say. That was fairly boring, I must say, but people saw the point of it, of course. And you also learned, well, there was a certain amount of drill as well and that type of thing. And you also learned to operate the naval codes. The naval codes were absolutely necessary, were a mixture of codes, but mainly it consisted of five figure groups. There was another code that used to consist of a mixture.